from the studios of 2RPH in Sydney. This is 30 Laps with Dick. I'm Richard Lyon. Welcome. Hey, danger, danger, Will Robinson. That was a phrase uttered by Robot 89 from the TV series Lost in Space, used now as a catchphrase to warn someone that he or she is about to do something really stupid or downright dangerous. 911, also written 911, is an emergency telephone number for the North American Numbering Plan, NANP, one of the eight N11 codes. Like other emergency numbers around the world, this number is intended for use in an emergency only, and using it for any other purpose, such as making false or prank calls, is a crime. Where's all this going? This week in 30 Laps. Well, you don't need to worry. It's not an emergency. It's not a prank call. It's not even danger, unless you're driving it too fast for the conditions. And it's not from the United States. It's from Stuttgart. And it's not 911. It's 911. It's the Porsche 911. A brief history this week on 30 Laps. And we'll probably have time for something else too, but let's get cracking on our one of the favourites of 30 Laps, the Porsche 911, and we'll talk about everything 911-ish. This comes from the online magazine Auto NXT, and it was written by Mike Meredith on the 14th of December 2020. 911, a brief history. German automaker Porsche builds a lightweight, rear-engine, two-door sports car that has been in existence for more than 50 years. And in 2017, the 911 reached a production milestone of more than 1 million cars. There have been decades of innovation, performance improvements, and leading-edge technology, as well as increases in size and weight. The 911 today continues as the innovative flagship sports car it has always been. The current 2020 Porsche 911 still looks remarkably similar to the original model from the 1950s. So let's take a look back at the history of one of the most recognised automotive shapes on the road. Okay, the first generation, the Porsche 901 prototype, debuted at the 1963 Frankfurt Motor Show as a successor to the Porsche 356. However, the name had to be changed prior to the launch in 1964 after French automaker Peugeot objected to the name, claiming that it owned the naming rights to the three-digit model numbers with a zero in the middle. The Porsche 911 went on sale in the fall or the autumn over down here in these parts in the autumn of 1964, powered by an air-cooled 2-litre flat six-cylinder engine producing 130 horsepower. In 1965, the automaker added the 912, which was powered by a flat four-cylinder engine. 1966 saw the Porsche 911S join the lineup with 160 horsepower. The first 911 model to be offered with the all-new iconic Fuchs Ford alloy wheels. Later that year, the 911 Targa debuted with a removable top and the stainless steel safety hoop behind the seats. A semi-automatic Sportomatic four-speed auto became available in 1967. Porsche continued to offer more powerful engines for the 911, with the engine size increasing to 2.2 litres in 1969 and 2.4 in 1971. The 1972 911 Carrera RS 2.7 has become one of the most popular 911s sought by collectors today. The car is so desirable that many replica versions have been created from other 911 models of the era. The 1972 911 Carrera RS 2.7 is motivated by a 210 horsepower engine, but it weighs only 2,200 pounds. It is also the first 911 model with Porsche's distinctive ducktail spoiler. A total of 81,100 first-generation 911s were produced. The 911 Turbo, now you're talking, arrived in the United States in 1976, powered by a turbocharged 3-litre flat-six, producing 245 horsepower and mated with a 4-speed manual transmission. For 1978, the 911 Turbo 3.3 got into the mix with an intercooled 3.3-litre turbocharged engine producing 265 horsepower. Oh, what a car. Although the exterior design of the third-generation Porsche 911 is not a dramatic change, it's easy to be distinguished by a new integrated bumper design. That said, engines undertook a major redesign of the platform under the skin to create a new, modern 911 with 85% new components. With the introduction of the third generation 911, known as the 964, Porsche added all-wheel drive for the first time. The 911 Carrera 4 debuted, as a 1989 model, while the previous generation 911 Carrera was also sold as a 1989 model before the arrival of the next generation 1990 Carrera 2 and the 1990 Carrera 2 Cabriolet. The 911 Turbo returned for 1991, powered by an intercooled and turbocharged 3.3-litre engine, producing 315 horsepower, and combined with a 5-speed manual transmission. The 911 Turbo S increased output to 322 horsepower, a total of 74,008 third-generation 911s were made. The fourth generation, which was the next generation, obviously after the third, with a 993 internal designation, is one of the most revered by Porsche enthusiasts. The last generation to be powered by an air-cooled flat six-cylinder engine. The body design is loved by many, and a lower front end allowed the previous round headlights to be laid back in a more oval shape. Sold in the US market for the 1995 to 1998 model years. The 993 featured a new aluminium chassis and was offered initially in Carrera Coupe, Carrera Cabriolet, Carrera 4 and Carrera 4 Cabriolet model mixes. Well, if you were driving a Carrera 4 Coupe or Carrera Cabriolet and you saw one of your friends, you'd give them a wave, wouldn't you? So I thought we better have a bit of new wave to go with it. Thank you, Mr. Nick Lowe. The 1995 911 Carrera and Carrera 4 were powered by a 3.6-litre flat six-cylinder producing 272 horsepower. Combined with either a 6-speed manual or a 4-speed Tiptronic. For 1966, the Teutonic automaker added the Carrera 4S Coupe. Now, you listen to all this because I'm going to be asking questions at the end of it. The Carrera Targa and the Turbo Coupe to the line. The Turbo Coupe is powered by a twin turbocharged 3.6-litre flat 6-cylinder engine. This is good stuff, isn't it? The Carrera 4S Coupe features the wider body of the turbo with a normally aspirated engine of the Carrera 4. The all-new Targa does away with the previous removable top, replaced with a large glass roof that slides back underneath the rear window. And we move to generation number 5. The Porsche 911 that arrived in the United States as a 1999 mark model heralded a major redesign and sea change at Porsche. The first 911 ever produced with a water-cooled engine. Known internally as the model designation Z996, the new model improved significantly in nearly every way, including performance, comfort, fuel efficiency, and emissions, most importantly. The design is an evolution of previous 911s, of course, influenced by the sharing of components with Porsche's new mid-engine and more marketable Boxster, the most obvious example being its controversial headlights with integrated turn signals. For 2002, Porsche engineers upgraded the Carrera engine to 3.6 litres, so it would produce 320 horsepower. Porsche then added the 911 GT3, powered by a twin-turbo 3.6-litre flat-six, which was a unit that generated 456 horsepower. During this productive era in Porsche history, the automaker added the 911 GT3 for 2004 with a normally aspirated 3.6-litre flat-six-cylinder producing 380 horsepower. Crikey. Following up behind, very closely I might add, was the 911S, the new Turbo S, where the next generation 911 arrived as a 2005 model. Porsche continued to sell the previous generation as the 911 Turbo S, powered by a twin turbocharged 3.6 litre producing 444 horsepower of torque. And 457 pounds per feet of torque, in American speak, delivered through a 6-speed manual transmission or a 5-speed Tiptronic S automatic. Total production for the 996 generation of the Porsche 911 was 173,000 vehicles. We can talk about the 7th generation and the 8th generation, but the numbers get confusing, so we might truncate this, I think. And perhaps we'll talk about the Targa. It's with the 7th generation. The 911 turbo, of course, continued into the 7th generation, as well extracting power from a twin turbocharged 3.8 litre, 500 horsepower. For 2014, the 911 Targa once again joined the lineup. Welcome back! Although this time, the design mimicked the original with a distinctive wide bar behind the seats, a removable roof section, and a wraparound rear window. The power-operated roof stows behind the rear seat at the push of a button, along with some very small golf clubs or a very small child. For 2015, the Carrera and the Carrera S both received 3-litre turbocharged engines, with the Carrera rating at 370 horsepower and the Carrera S at 420. On May the 11th, 2017, Porsche marked the production of the 1 millionth Porsche 911. Finished in Irish green with handmade leather seats, seat covers featuring the original Pepita pattern from 1964. The instrument cluster says 1 million 911s, and the numbers and lighting are shimmering green with silver surround for the instruments. Sounds horrible. Anyway, the handmade mahogany steering wheel features a Porsche crest from 1964 on the hub. That's better. The 8th generation kicked off in the 2018 LA Auto Show, arriving in the US market as the 2020 model. Known by internal code of 992, the 2020 Carrera and Carrera S are wider and have LED headlights. The 2020 Carrera S and 4S are powered by the next generation turbocharged flat six that produces some 443 horsepower. The Carrera and Carrera 4 are powered by turbocharged 3-litre unit that produces 379 horsepower. Lots of horses under the bonnet there. The new Porsche 911 Turbo sports a 3.8-litre six-cylinder boxer engine with two symmetrical VTG turbochargers to produce 572 horsepower. Whew. And over the outgoing 67 pounds per foot of torque over the outgoing 911 Turbo. The rear-mounted engine gets teamed up with an 8-speed PDK transmission specifically calibrated to the powerful turbo engine. And so is the price tag, I might say, dear listeners. We'll leave Danger Will Robinson there. Thanks to Mike Meredith and the AutoNext online magazine for a brief history of the 911s and all the other 11s that went with it. Well, that's New Wave with a bit of a German feel for our friends in Stuttgart, hey? Let's move on to something completely different. From one online magazine to another, Practical Motoring. And this is written by Alex Ray. Things to look at when buying a used classic or enthusiast car. Option codes, factory standard and unmolested. Does it really matter when looking to buy your own slice of history? Well, let's see what Alex has to say. The level of detail required for a classic car to be considered original can become pedantic. One owner we spoke to with a beautifully restored Dodge Charger had installed a sticker on the wrong side and on the wrong angle and was called out for it at a car show. Thankfully, finding cars that are at least genuine is not such a minefield, but there are some traps for new players. This guide will cover basics such as, do the numbers match? Are all the original options there? And or is this a fake or a replica? This is not used car buying advice covering drivability and the condition of parts. At the affordable end of the classic car world are vehicles in poor condition that have lived a hard life and had donor parts installed to keep them going. Moving to the pointy end are the expensive investments, which, apart from looking pristine, will still have all the original items as from the factory, with nothing out of place or non-standard. Affordable cars advertised with donor bits and non-original condition usually show an honest seller. But the problem arises when the car is advertised as an original, but it is not the case, and that can be hard to pick. In this instance, the loss of money can be in the six figures, and in most cases, it's buyer beware. So, it pays to take due diligence and, if in any doubt, always seek expert advice before agreeing to hand over any cash. The catchphrase often heard when a seller justifies a classic's higher than normal price is, it's got matching numbers. This is when the compliance plate on the car matches the stamped chassis and engine numbers. These numbers would have to have been originally assigned to the car when it left the factory. But, for instance, the original engine broke its bottom end and at the same type of engine with different numbers was installed, the car is no longer matching numbers. And this can significantly reduce the asking price. Typically, a car known to have a weak engine or that it is commonly used for track work should be approached with caution if wanting to buy a numbers matching car. In the decades of its life, there's been a good chance the engine would have blown, and the cheapest course of action is to source a good engine from a wrecked car rather than rebuild a blown one. In some cases, the owner may have kept the original, but you'd have to be lucky. The older the car, the harder it can be to check the numbers, because records are usually thin. If there's original paperwork, that's a good start, and it should have a record of the VIN, chassis and engine numbers, and possibly items such as the gearbox and other options, which we'll cover later. Vehicles sold in Australia for road registration and have a compliance plate mounted in the engine bay with a record of the VIN, chassis and engine number. Using this is a guide. Check the number on the block and the number stamped onto the vehicle's chassis. If they don't match, something is starting to smell. Unfortunately, there are some dodgy operators out there who will go to great lengths to stamp fake compliance plate and increase the value of a non-original vehicle. So if you really are serious about buying a classic and you don't have much experience or knowledge, it is advised to join a relevant car club and start asking the hard questions. Nearly all car clubs are friendly, and there'll be members who are more than happy to come and inspect the vehicle, and they'll have a better eye for picking up on things like a dodgy restoration or period incorrectness items. Hotter or limited edition vehicles may have matching numbers but could be a mock-up as of a base model. Such cars are not worth anything near what a real one is, and so it's important to have a reference or a knowledgeable person, someone who doesn't mispronounce knowledgeable person, to compare the numbers on the car, so that of the manufacturer's records. In the case of a hotter model, the engine code will usually differ to the normal blocks, and this should match the VIN number. Special models will usually have a special code to signify its difference, and this should be on the car. Such intricacies help build the case for legitimising a genuine from a fake, but it requires intimate knowledge and experience, which the average punter will not have. It is possible to obtain a list of differences either from books or online, but again, joining a club and getting involved will be a fast track into understanding the difference of what a fake or a replica is missing. Some circles prefer for true classic cars to be in an entirely original condition, otherwise known as a survivor car, and can extend to extremes such as having original paint without any repairs, rust which has not been cut out of a donor metal plate, and original items like seat upholstery, alternator, stickers and carburetors, covers intact. The appreciation for such a car is up to the buyer. It might be that it's completely original, but as the saying goes, rust never sleeps. More simple discrepancies to spot can be a period or model incorrect items. Common is that the wheels are not the original design or size. The carburetor may have been changed for a bigger one, or a spoiler has been added for aesthetic reasons. Replacing or removing these might not be a big issue, but it will be added expense, and fitting a non-standard body part will require a trip to the panel shop. Picking period, incorrect or non-standard parts will require a very keen eye and some expertise, and having a book for reference at the time will help. It's always buyer beware. Classic car buying begins with a decision from the heart for most, but it can be a minefield to navigate and get through without being ripped off. And in most cases, it's buyer beware unless an expert is signed off saying the car is the real deal. If you're considering a classic vehicle, read as many books and get involved with online forums and clubs to expand your knowledge. But if looking for an investment or spending serious money on an original, we recommend definitely you join the relevant car club and finding an expert who can assist in inspecting the vehicle with you. That's all very good advice, folks. And we thank Alex Rose for his information that can be found on the practicalmotoring.com online magazine. We've got time for an interesting car fact, I think. Get away from all this. The auto industry is plagued with different metrics. We've been full of it all episode today. To measure the same thing, the uses dependent on the country. For example, power has at least four measurements. Horsepower, brake horsepower, and PS, which is German Förderstärke, which are very similar, but none exactly the same as another. In 1992, the EU deemed a new power standard kilowatts. To confuse us even more, gallons are not the same in the are not the same. That's quite true. I've even confused myself here. The US uses gallons that are 17% smaller than gallons used in Britain. And much of the rest of the world uses litres, the metric standard. The only automotive metric that is standard everywhere are wheel sizes. Yes, even places like Europe, which abandoned the non-metric measurement standards, or indeed centuries ago, still use inches. Getting the correct tyres are vitally important to car safety, and we can all be glad that for once, everybody has decided on one thing and have stuck to it. Inches for car tyre measurements. Imperial gallons, metric gallons, 10-gallon hats, it's very confusing. But at least if you start talking tyre sizes and you talk about inches, everybody's on the same wavelength, or the same track, or tread, for that matter. And we'll finish on one from Australia. GM's auto division, Holden, had a performance arm called the Holden Dealer Team, HDT, run by the enigmatic Peter Brock. In 1986, Brock began to install a gadget dubbed the Energy Polarizer into his HDT vehicles. The machine contained crystals and magnets and an epoxy resin that he claimed improved the performance and handling of the vehicles through aligning the molecules. GM was not impressed by this theory and a total lack of any evidence-based benefits and dropped its association with Brock quickly. It set up the Holden Special Vehicles instead, in conjunction with Scottish businessman Thomas Walkinshaw. Brock, of course, died in an accident in 2006. And that's where we'll leave it all today, all the facts and figures about 9-11s, what to do when you're looking for spending some money on an original, make sure all the numbers match, and a couple of quick fun facts at the end. I hope you've enjoyed yourself this afternoon. Tonight, this evening, whenever you're hearing it, wherever you're hearing it, I've certainly enjoyed bringing it to you. We'll talk about something else next week, hey? Until then, bye for now. ¶¶